Silence is powerful, but it's often lost in the white noise of emails and texts and constant connection. Too much noise is deafening, but silence can be dangerous too. And silence fascinates journalist and filmmaker Harriet Shawcross. As a journalist, she is paid not to be a loss for words, but as a teenager, she stopped talking to anyone, except a select few, for about a year. And she investigates the power of silence in her new book. It's called Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. Harriet Shawcross joins us now. Hello there.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Such an interesting topic right now, because it feels like one of the biggest challenges we have is getting people to say less. Do we respect do we respect silence enough? Can it actually be good for us?
Yeah, interesting. I don't know if we do. I think, like you said in your introduction, there's such an emphasis at the moment on always responding to things, whether that's, you know, texts, WhatsApps, emails, whatever. And actually, like, silence can have quite a profound effect on you personally and on your life. I think I spent quite a lot of time in researching the book talking to people that had spent a lot of time in silence. And I think for all of them, it had a really profound impact on them. And personally, I went and spent some time on a couple of different silent retreats and, yeah, found it to be a very kind of profound experience in terms of how you relate to other people, how you relate to the world. So, yeah.
But it has a flip side. As a teenager, you went silent, not completely, but how do you describe what you experienced?
Yeah, sure. So the way I describe it in the book is that I lost the ability to talk in the ways that kind of make us human. So when I was at school, I went to a boarding school, but I was a day pupil there. And when I was at school, I found that I couldn't kind of converse with people normally. So I would, if a teacher asked me a direct question, you know, like, what's the answer to this? And I would respond. But I wouldn't kind of chat with people. I wouldn't make jokes with people. I wouldn't do, you know, what we're doing now, just kind of, you know, conversing normally. So I kind of lost that, you know, human side of communication for about a year or so. And I think for me, what it was when I kind of got to the school, I was one of three day pupils in a year of about 100. And I remember very vividly being sat down with this housemistress who said, you know, it'd be very important that you don't talk about your life at home to other people, to the other girls, because they can't go home and it might upset them. And I think I really took that to heart. And then shortly afterwards, my father was made redundant. And that was a very shameful thing for my family, like in our household. For my mum, certainly, it was kind of, don't talk about what's happening to dad. It's, you know, it's nobody else's business. And I think that those two things combined meant that I kind of found it very difficult to actually talk about what was happening for me. And as a result, kind of took a bit of a step back from the world, is how I kind of describe it in the book. Into this, yeah, I mean, it wasn't complete silence, but it was a very dehumanizing kind of silence, I'd say, of like the kind of the human connection between me and other people was, you know, lost for a while, I think.
Did you realize what you were doing at the time?
Yeah, I did. I had very vivid memories of kind of watching kind of conversations happen with me kind of standing there and thinking, like, you haven't said anything for a really long time. Like, why aren't you participating? Why, you know, what are you doing? I had a very strong sense that it wasn't normal. It wasn't intentional. Like, it wasn't, I kind of didn't intentionally stop speaking, but when it was happening, I was very aware that it wasn't who I was and that it wasn't a kind of normal way of behaving, but I didn't know how to stop it.
And there's a syndrome sometimes referred to as childhood mutism. What does the research show about the impacts that parents can have on when children stop talking?
Oh, interesting. So when I first started researching the book, I thought that so in the UK it's called selective mutism, and I thought that's something that might have happened, that might explain why I stopped talking. So a kid with selective mutism will not be able to talk to people, certain people, or in certain situations. So most normally that's like at school, so they might talk totally normally with their parents at home, and then when they get into the classroom they suddenly find that they freeze and they can't speak. And in the past, it was seen as, it was called elective mutism, which kind of reflects the fact that it was seen as something that they were choosing. They were seen as being like difficult or perhaps shy, or, and as you say, often parents were blamed, and it was assumed there must have been something that they'd done that had stopped the child from talking. But I guess now the thinking in the UK certainly is that it's actually more like a phobia of speaking. So It's in the same way that an arachnophobe will see a spider and kind of freeze up. It's the same kind of thing. When a child with selective mutism has an expectation to talk, they will have this physical kind of freeze mechanism and not be able to do anything. And the way to treat it is the way you treat a phobia, which is with very kind of small steps at the child's own pace, letting them, you know, realize that there is nothing to be frightened of and that it is something that they're able to do. So I guess in terms of what a parent can do, it would be following that kind of treatment pattern, I guess, of like taking very small steps with them and, you know, telling them that this is something that they will get over and it will get better.
Yeah, there's actually a camp in America for kids who don't talk, and the motto is get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Does it tend to help the kids who attend?
There's quite a few different kind of camps in America. So the one you're talking about is called We Speak, and I went and did some filming there, and it's interesting in that it's for teenagers. So there's a lot of kind of treatment around kind of preschool, like young kids going to primary school. That's when it normally kind of manifests itself. But these kids were a bit older. They were kind of 12 through to like 15. And you're right, the way it's treated in the States is a little bit different to in the UK, in that it's there's more emphasis on kind of pushing the kids to kind of get through whatever it is that's stopping them from speaking. And kind of watching this camp take place, it can be quite uncomfortable. You know, you see these kids that are clearly in quite profound distress and finding it very distressing being forced to speak more than they want to. But when I spoke to the kind of psychologists who were running the camp, their logic was, it sounds a bit crass, but it's that kind of like feel the fear and do it anyway. Again, that kind of like pushing through the anxiety to show yourself that you can do it. But watching the kids go through this often looked quite painful, whether it's something as simple as getting them to order a frozen yogurt when that's something they would never do, or trying to speak to other kids whenever they're at high school, they don't talk to anyone. It can kind of look quite cruel, but certainly all the parents I spoke to were really pleased with the results and felt that, you know, it had enabled their kids to start building kind of human connections with people again.
I should mention there's an organisation in New Zealand for kids and adults who have selective mutism, and it's called Voice, if people want to look it up. How common is it in children?
It depends what the age of the child is. I think in kind of primary school kids, it's about 1 in 150, and then it becomes much, much more uncommon as kids get older.
I guess
about 1 in 150.
Yeah, I guess the question too is, how do you know when silence is a problem in kids?
I guess it depends. So again, the difference between someone with selective mutism and someone that's shy, the way it was explained to me is that someone who's kind of shy will warm up like in time as they get to know the people or the situation or whatever, and the silence will kind of fall away. Whereas a child that's got SM, it's almost like the more time they spend in the situation that's making them uncomfortable, the more and more and more they will retreat, and the harder it will be to break that. And I guess, you know, in terms of when it's a problem, it's when it's something that isn't chosen. It's when it's something that a child has no, or an adult or anyone, has no control over. That's when I think it becomes, you know, difficult or dangerous, I guess.
I'm talking to Harriet Shawcross, who is author of the book Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say, and she investigates in that book the power of silence. What happens when children never find their voice again and go into adulthood afraid of talking?
This is, you know, this should clearly be caveated with the fact that like this is, it's really uncommon for this to happen, but when it does, it can bring with it kind of other mental health problems. As you might expect, if you're not able to kind of express yourself throughout, you know, growing up, this can have a kind of knock-on effect as you get older. I didn't speak to them. I had email correspondence with several kind of teenagers, older teenagers and young adults that still had trouble speaking. And for a lot of them, actually, it had got more pervasive. So it might have started with just not being able to talk at school, and then it would kind of spread into other areas of their lives. And I guess the longer it carries on, the harder it is to break. So it can have quite a big impact if it isn't kind of dealt with when the child is younger.
We should mention that some people in religious orders take a vow of silence voluntarily. You found a silent order of nuns in the heart of London. How does that work?
Yeah, it's this great place called Tyburn Convent, which is it's right on the corner of Hyde Park, kind of looks out onto Speaker's Corner. So, you know, it's got this huge kind of road running past the front of it, and it's amazing. You kind of walk in through the door, which incidentally isn't locked, which is kind of nuts as well, right in the middle of London. You kind of walk, you can walk straight into the chapel, and there's always a nun in kind of silent supplication there. And when I first went there, actually, I kind of went in through the wrong door and walked straight into this chapel and this kind of nun praying, which was quite an arresting sight. And then, yeah, and how it works. So it was quite interesting. I had a long chat with the media nun. So her kind of calling is to part of her calling is to talk about the order's work with the media. So so she was able to have a chat with me. And yeah, so she was interesting about silence. So there are several things to say about it. So one, even though it's a silent order, there are kind of checks and balances on the silence. So if they need to speak to another order member, they can. There are kind of periods of recreation when they are able to converse with each other. So it's not, even in a silent order, the silence isn't absolute. And she was quite interesting as well. So she became a nun slightly later in life, in her 30s, and she'd kind of had a whole life. And she, one of the things that worried her was that she'd had counselling, and she was worried that the order wouldn't accept her because they might not think she was kind of, what's the best way of putting this? They might not think she was kind of mentally stable enough to deal with the demands of spending such a lot of time in silence. And what she found is when she entered the order, the way she described it is she had all these kind of terrifying visions of kind of, like rape, of assault, like kind of things that she had no control over, and she didn't know where they were coming from. And it was something about kind of being plunged into silence that had like dredged all this stuff up for her. And she said she figured out eventually that it was coming. She was really into movies, and she was suddenly like, oh, it's all these scenes from these movies that I've seen. So it was scenes from Alien and stuff. But, you know, and as soon as she'd realized what it was and kind of connected language to it, I guess, and said, oh, this is movies, it went away. And she was okay. But she was really interesting to talk to in terms of the positive power of silence, which obviously, you know, she's chosen to live a life centered around kind of silent prayer, but also the kind of slightly scarier aspect of what can happen if you kind of remove language from most areas of your life.
Yeah, one monk told you that it's like love. When it's good, and when it's bad, it's dangerous. What happened to him when he was alone and quiet?
Yeah, it's such a good analogy of like that it's something that you kind of instinctively think is good, but it can kind of, you know, drive you completely mad in the way that love can. So he spent 9 months on a kind of silent and also solitary retreat, which is obviously incredibly full on. And yeah, it was really interesting what happened to him. He'd been dragging some wood up a hill. This was in kind of southern Spain, and he had pulled a muscle in his chest, and he ended up convincing himself that he was having a heart attack and that he was going to die. And he described it as that he had no control of his mind or of his body, and he just couldn't get a grip on what was actually happening without language. And the only way that he could kind of pull himself back to the real world was to break the silence and speak to someone. So he had to call a doctor friend of his, who said, well, of course you're not having a heart attack, don't be crazy. And it was only kind of adding language to the experience that made it possible for him to make sense of it and deal with it and move on. And for him, I mean, from a Buddhist perspective, like silence gives you a sense of a kind of expanded sense of consciousness, insight into the true nature of reality, however you want to describe it. And for him, I think he also found it quite a profound religious experience, this sense of he could have this, the way he described it, he was like, he could have this conscious thought of like, my mind is not my own, my body is not my own, I have no control of any of these things, and yet there's still somewhere this voice that's thinking, my mind is not my own and my body is not my own. Anyway, so for him, it was kind of quite a profound religious experience. But yeah, I think it was interesting that the only way he could kind of survive it was to put language to it and to break the kind of silent retreat conditions that he'd sought out.
There's this idea we have that you can talk your way out of trauma when something happens. In New Zealand, we've suffered really terrible earthquakes over the last 10 years, and often counsellors are sent in to help people cope. So how did that go over in Nepal after the deadly earthquake they had over there?
Yeah, so I went over to Nepal and spent some time with some psychologists who've been studying the impact of kind of storytelling, I guess, on how people process trauma. So they ran a kind of study with people who had been through the earthquake in 2015, and they were studying something called narrative exposure therapy, which is basically telling and retelling and retelling your story until it doesn't have such a kind of hold on you. And they found that, I mean, when I spoke to individual people that had been part of it, they found that they felt that the people they'd spoken to had been helped by it. But overall, the study failed. They didn't get enough clinical data and it didn't work. And I think that was for lots of different reasons. And when I spoke to an anthropologist out there about kind of the Nepali psyche, I guess, the way she described it was quite interesting, that like kind of talking therapy in like the Western sense, you know, this kind of thing that we think, of course, you know, if you talk about something that'll make it better, doesn't really make sense in the context of Nepal. So the way she described it was, because it's a majority kind of Buddhist society, she said there's this idea of dukkha, which is that life is inherently unsatisfying and that suffering is inevitable. So the fact that you are suffering is not kind of pathologized, it's absolutely to be expected. So that kind of changes whether or not you feel that you need to kind of talk about stuff. And she said that also suffering is somaticized, so it's experienced in the body and described in terms of like bodily sensations. So rather than kind of talking about how traumatized you may feel, you may just experience a tingling in your limbs or a feeling of tension or things that kind of don't map so clearly onto kind of emotions that we can talk about. And also in terms of mental health, she was like, if you talk about mental health, again, it doesn't really make much sense, because the way emotions like trauma are experienced is in an organ called the heart mind, which we don't really have in a Western context.
It's a lovely concept though.
Isn't it? Yeah. And that's so she was just like, and it's not to say there isn't talking therapy, because there is, but it would just look very different. So for example, there were kind of groups of locally trained counselors who did go and talk to people after the earthquake, but it was much more solution focused. So kind of, it wasn't just talk, it was solution focused. And there was things like, you wouldn't sit opposite someone making direct eye contact with them. You would, you know, you would always make sure that you weren't making eye contact. You might talk about things and experiences you were having in your heart mind. You might talk about tension. You might talk about physical symptoms. So it's not that like talking therapy doesn't happen. It just looks very different to what we in a kind of Western context might expect.
And there was a different sort of silence in your life, your silence around your sexuality. What changed when you decided to talk to your parents about that?
I think it was something that I'm bisexual, and I guess on one level I'd always known that I found women attractive, but on another level had just never acknowledged it to myself, never felt able to talk about it. And yeah, it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I felt in a place where I could begin to talk about these things. And I don't know what it was that changed, really. It just felt like the right time, and it felt like something that I was able to articulate, I guess.
There is power in telling your story. You talk in the book about the Samaritans in the UK. It's a bit like our service lifeline over here. And that was started with the idea that talking and listening can save a life, which was, I imagine, pretty revolutionary in 1935.
Yeah, it was. So it was a bit later than 1935. So it was set up in the 50s. And it was set up by this guy called Chad Varra, who's he was a priest. And it kind of came about because he had to conduct the funeral of a 13-year-old girl who'd killed herself. She'd taken her own life. And that was because she started her periods and thought she was dying and that she had some terrible disease and she had no one to talk to about it. And he found that experience really profound. And it's what eventually prompted him to set up the Samaritans, because he just felt very strongly that no one should ever feel that ashamed or isolated or alone or have no one to talk to. And I guess in the 50s it was quite revolutionary. So what's interesting about the Samaritans, I spoke to this guy called Alan, who's great. He's the longest running Samaritans. He's been volunteering since 1960 and is still volunteering today, which is kind of nuts. But But back in the kind of early 60s, he was in Liverpool. You know, the things they were dealing with were incredibly taboo. So homosexuality was still illegal. Abortion was illegal. And often they were talking to people who had nowhere else to talk to, nowhere else to express what was happening for them. So whether that was gay men who, the examples he gave to me were gay men who were being blackmailed, women who had either just had an abortion or were seeking abortion, or even people having, you know, extramarital affairs. Like, I think it was a very different world, a much more kind of constricted world with a lot more taboos. And having an organization that was set up explicitly to allow people a space to talk about things that they couldn't talk about anywhere else was, yeah, probably was quite revolutionary. You're right.
Has your view of silence changed, or did it change in writing the book?
I think I went into the book, I think the kind of more negative, darker side of silence was a bit of a surprise to me, in terms of, we've talked about the experience of the Buddhist who felt he was going mad, or the nun who had kind of these visions of rape. Or I think the power of silence, of what happens to your mind if you don't have kind of language to cling onto, and we don't have the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and how we fit into the world. I think I was probably a bit naive about that, because I'd had amazing experiences on silent retreats and just thought, you know, silence was great. And it was really, I think, informative to see the kind of potentially more negative side of it. But I think, like, personally, it was quite a cathartic experience writing the book, because I guess it allowed me to kind of process and move beyond this very formative experience when I was younger and had not been able to articulate what was happening for me. And then the experience of writing the book and being able to put my life story, for want of a better word, into words was, you know, is quite a powerful thing to be able to do. So, yeah.
It's great. Both of those. Great book. Great title too. Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say, by Harriet Shawcross. Harriet, thanks so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, you're so welcome. No problem.